morning. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, former State Representative Reggie Fullwood joins me in studio. The number to call if you want to get in with questions or comments is 549-2937. Then later, we'll take a closer look at a new law that goes into effect today, no less, which bans indoor vaping in some places. Plus, Culpepper is going to be here with the latest in sports news. All of that just ahead. But first this hour, former State Representative Reggie Fullwood has a new leadership position 2 years after he was sentenced in federal court in 2017. Fullwood pleaded guilty to using campaign funds for personal use and failing to file tax returns. His probation was supposed to last until February 2020, but federal court records show a judge let him out of the probation early so he could take a new job at Operation New Hope, a local organization that offers second chance solutions to formerly incarcerated individuals. Some might say a perfect fit for his own second chance opportunity. Fullwood joins us now in for a closer look here in the studio. The number to call again is 549-2937 with your questions. What do you have for him? Good morning, Mr. Fullwood.
Good morning, Charles.
Thanks for being here. So first, let's kind of get into some of the things that I know listeners are probably having on their mind. You pleaded guilty to wire fraud and failing to file your tax returns a couple of years ago.
Yes.
How has that criminal conviction impacted your life to this point?
Well, I mean, there's the obvious, right? There's, the challenges that come along with that. But, I just thank God for family and friends who've been supportive throughout the process. And it's been a journey. So, but it's something I've been thankful for the journey itself because I've learned a lot about myself and I've grown quite a bit from it.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of you learned a lot, but what are some of the biggest lessons learned throughout this process? Do you believe that you've encountered in these last 2.5 years?
Well, I mean, how much time do we have? I think the more obvious is the fact that you just have to persevere through struggles and strife. And those are, all of us face challenges and, kind of going through the criminal justice system is just a very uncomfortable for anybody, especially a system that oftentimes, most of us feel like there needs to be even more reform. And reform is a big issue right now in the state as a whole. And so that's something that, I think we, the legislature and all of us need to be focused on is some of the reform efforts that are out there.
So do you think that your experience informs you on things that you're doing now? And if you had to, what are some of the things that you would have done differently regarding your experience?
I think my experience does make me uniquely qualified for the job. At Operation New Hope, running the Ready for Work program. Although I've never been to prison, some of the challenges that many of our clients have, these are people who are getting out of jail, who have some mental health issues, or may struggle to find a job, struggle with family reunification, struggle with simple things that we don't think about, like transportation. You've been in jail for 2 or 3 years, your license probably isn't valid. So how do you get around town for job interviews and things of that nature? So the beauty of Ready for Work is that we provide all those services to our clients. And, it's really about getting people back on their feet. And, some of the challenges, again, I can't relate to being in prison, but I can relate to some of the stresses and anxiety and some of the insecurities that come along with dealing with going through the legal system.
Okay. Let's go back a little bit. One of the things that people remember about your term as an elected official is that you I think you were the youngest city council member elected at the time, correct?
Yes. Back in 1999, it seemed like it was, eons ago. But yes, I was the youngest council person ever elected. And actually, Charles, I think we met, I was on the campaign trail probably back in 1998 when we met for the first time.
That's right.
And so that was a journey. I served 2 terms on city council and then in the state legislature for 3 terms.
So with that, I believe most people would say that you were probably a well-respected public official during your time in office, both city council and during a state house term. Do you feel like you let your constituents down, because of the situation that you were in, because of your conviction?
Yeah, and In some ways, I certainly do. I think I, you know, I love being in public office and I love serving. There were several situations that I regret. You know, part of me regrets not going to trial, but you know, I take ownership of the mistakes I made. And I think at the end of the day, it was a right decision to do what I did. I accepted a plea bargain and now we're here. And I think things happen for a reason. So God's grace is just so awesome. And I'm ready for work for the right reason at the right time.
So given the fact that all this has happened over the last 2.5 years, how do you think you're being received over the last 2.5 years by your community? I know you just said you feel like you let the constituents down. But over the past 2 years, how do you think you've been received by the community?
You know, it's been great. I haven't had any haven't had any negative experiences, you know, from, you know, the people I run into at the grocery store to volunteering. I mean, I've spent a ton of hours volunteering over the past couple of years, talking to youth about, you know, the challenges in life and the fact that they can overcome anything. I've volunteered at several not-for-profits, you know, just giving back. Public service is something that it's important to me. And so after, you know, my sentencing, it never stopped. I had to do some community service hours as a part of it, but also, you know, just being active and involved is something that's always been important. The reception from the community has been fine. I mean, I think most people realize that good people make mistakes or make bad decisions and you know, you just own up to it and you move on.
The number to call is 549-2937 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. We're speaking with former State Representative Reggie Fullwood about his past and his present and his future. So now, like you mentioned, you're serving as a program director for Ready for Work at Operation New Hope. What are you thinking? What makes this good for you, a good fit for you in your current role?
Well, just my experiences. Kevin Gay founded the Operation New Hope 20 years ago, and he's done a fabulous job with the program. So I'm honored to be there. It's a nationally recognized program. We have a great team of folks from our case managers to our job coaches to our instructors to our leadership. So me coming in, it's really to help the organization grow. One of the things I'm excited about is that we're opening up an office in St. Augustine in a few months to serve the St. Johns County area. And then we're looking at expanding even more. So we're a nationally recognized program, and we feel like, of course, second chances matter. And we're just taking that message. We want to expand it throughout the state and just look at opportunities to help as many people as possible. So my experience, not only my elected experience, but before that, I ran a not-for-profit and just been very active in the community and throughout the state. So the things that Operation New Hope wants to do are Ready for Work. It's in line with my experiences and where the organization wants to grow.
So what are some of those things that you see right now? I mean, those things that you bring into the table that you're able to utilize to help people with a second chance?
You know, every Monday we have orientation. So right now we have a class of people that's starting, and it's probably a pretty big class. 15, anywhere between 10 and 15 people start our program every Monday morning. And I like to go into those orientations and I talk to them and I say, hey, my joke is that old hair club for men joke. Uh-huh. You know, not only am I the program director, but I'm a client in essence, because a lot of the things that are the participants have gone through, you know, I have. So we try to make it as relatable as possible with our folks. So, you know, whether they're talking about their mental health needs, we have that for them. You know, we try to instill the fact that, hey, if you trust our program, you stick with us for 4 or 5 weeks, we will help you get a job and we will help you get back on your feet. We will help you reunite with your family if that's what you need. We will help you, you know, find a career that's going to be beneficial to you in the long run. And if you look at our recidivism numbers, we're well below 10% yeah. of our people end up going back to prison. I mean, it's the lowest in the state. So we're doing a great job, and our goal is to expand and do more and help more people.
It's definitely an issue. Just my time when in Jacksonville, Virginia, recidivism wasn't a big issue. And the fact that I know that Operation New Hope has been working in that space for a long time. We have a caller on the line that wants to get in and get a question. Mike is on the phone. Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How you doing?
All right.
I just want to touch base and tell him I'm glad that he's back on the scene. He's back in the community. And he hasn't give up in terms of leaving his field and the line of work that he does. I hope to see him maybe possibly run for the mayor and keep on keeping on, you know? That's what it's all about, you know? Live and learn. You're always able to take a negative and turn to a positive. That's my thing there with.
Well, thank you, Mike, for the call.
And thank you, Mike. I appreciate the encouragement. I will not be running for mayor, I can assure you of that. But, you know, and Charles, those are the type of responses I've gotten. You know, I went through a tough couple of years, and running into people like Mike or folks who've been very encouraging throughout the process has been very helpful.
Let's speak to that on a non-personal level. When we're talking about second chances, it has been your experience so far that most of the people who you come in contact with are pretty much good people who made bad choices or bad decisions, who are looking for an opportunity to get back on their feet or to turn their life around. Has that been your experience for not just you, but other people as well?
I think, for the most part. And I think in the program, there's sort of it sort of runs the gamut. So you have some people who made multiple mistakes. They've had a life full of making bad decisions, and they finally hit rock bottom and say, hey, you know, the last 15 years I've been making mistakes, and now I want to get my life together. And so we have those folks, or we have folks who just maybe made a white collar mistake and they were a nurse, or they were a doctor or a teacher, and now they're back. They had to serve some time, and now they're trying to get back on their feet. So it sort of runs the gamut of some of the more softer crimes to more hardened crimes. You know, we have people who may have been in prison for 20 to 25 years for, you know, different reasons, and they get out and they say, you know what, I finally want to get my life together. And one of the more touching things you'll ever hear, if you sit through one of our graduations, we have graduation every Friday. If you listen to some of the stories from some of the people who are graduating from the program, I mean, I think I'm a big, tough, macho guy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's times where, you know, I've almost cried listening to some people's stories. We had a lady a few weeks ago who said, look, I've never completed anything in my life, and I didn't think I could complete this program. But, you know, being here today, you've changed my life. I know I can reach out to my kids and reunite with my kids, and I know that I can be a better person because of this program. So I challenge anyone to come to one of our graduations and walk out of there thinking that, you know, this program isn't doing great, or people don't deserve second chances.
Mm-hmm. What happens is there's a stigma behind people who've been incarcerated or been convicted that's it. You know, they're no longer citizens worthy of the community, and have a hard time. They have to go through extra things getting back into good graces with society. With that, I know you talked a little bit about criminal justice reform. What are your thoughts there? I mean, where do you see real opportunities for improvement within criminal justice reform? You know, one of the things that we've been made aware of, you know, you had a referendum that passed last November for convicted felons to have the right to vote. And then just over to Friday, I guess it was Friday that the governor signed into law a bill saying that they had to complete all of their restitution before they were able to have their rights restored, voting rights restored. Mm-hmm. Things like that, are those considered to be barriers for helping people with chances, and where are sort of opportunities for improvement?
Yeah, there's certainly unfortunately there's a lot of barriers. But, you know, again, here's the beauty of criminal justice reform. Whether we're talking about Florida or Texas, you know, it's been a bipartisan effort. Before, it had been one side sort of pushing. Now it's a great bipartisan effort. Texas went from the state that probably locked more people up than anywhere else in the world to one of the states that has the best reform movement, where they're totally changed their philosophy on the criminal justice system. And I think, you know, people are realizing more and more, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, that, you know, it makes sense. I mean, it saves the state and taxpayers a ton of money. Mm-hmm. I mean, for for a long time, we've over-prosecuted and we've over-sentenced. And unfortunately, it's been mostly folks of color who have gotten over-sentenced, especially the crack cocaine era and the 10-20 life era. I mean, there was people who got sentenced to multiple years for having small amounts of crack cocaine. And then there's people who had large amounts of regular cocaine who got lesser sentences. I mean, there were some common sense things that can change. We have a great state attorney. Melissa Nelson she's doing some great stuff. I don't know if most people have heard about the Clifford Williams story. Mm-hmm. Clifford Williams is someone that we're helping at Operation New Hope. We deal with Clifford on a weekly basis, trying to help him get back on his feet. And for those who don't know, this man was in prison for 43 years, yeah. 43 years for a crime that he didn't commit. And thanks to Melissa Nelson and her efforts in her office, he was able to get out, he and his nephew. And so that's another example of how flawed the criminal justice system is. And unfortunately, there are still people that are innocent, that are serving, that have served decades in prison that need to be released. So criminal justice reform is real and it needs to continue.
Yeah. And that number to call is 549-2937. We're talking with former State Representative Reggie Fullwood, and we're kind of delving into some of the areas around criminal justice reform where I'm talking about Operation New Hope and people who are engaged in helping people with second chance solutions find real opportunity to help people come back into society and become mainstream and productive. With that, I want to talk a little bit of politics with you.
Do I have to?
I couldn't have you here if I didn't do that.
Okay.
Given what you see currently going on in our political stage, I know that you said you're not going to run again, but what do you see some of the opportunities left on the table, in particular, maybe perhaps the Democratic Party strategy for local success, maybe some of the state opportunities, because, you know, Florida is a purple state and teeter totters on back and forth for becoming a blue state and red state. And of course, in November, Duval County went for Andrew Gillum and went blue, pretty much blue for Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson, but didn't deliver in the mayor's race a few months later.
Yeah, Florida is an interesting dynamic in politics. One of the few, it seems like we've been purple for a while now. I've sort of been out of the game and deliberately sort of been staying out of politics for the last few years. And so I think, as a former, Democratic elected official, it was always a challenge that the issues that were important to us, we felt like were the people's issues, right? And mm-hmm. I think somehow the party has to really make a better connection with the people on issues like education and even criminal justice reform, continuing criminal justice reform. So I don't know the solution, but I mean, I know some of it's leadership. You have to continue to have strong leadership in the parties and just kind of come up with the right messaging that's relatable to people, especially young people. I think, the opportunities for Democrats, if we're talking about Democrats, are really with young folks. But I think what I would get excited about if I was in politics, still in politics, is looking at these criminal justice reform efforts and saying, wow, finally, there's some bipartisanship that's going on, right? Finally, Democrats and Republicans can get together and work on a solution that makes sense for everyone. And so I think, if we continue to look for some bipartisan, education has always been a big issue, right? There's certainly areas that we can work, Democrats and Republicans can work together for the good of our children.
So we can see you perhaps playing a role and criminal justice reform through Operation New Hope you all sort of the experts there.
Yeah, I don't know if we're the experts, but there's certainly, we don't push a whole lot of policy issues. We try to focus on the clients and helping clients, but there are some policy issues that help our clients specifically. I'll give you an example. Melissa Nelson has a driver's license diversion program. Mm-hmm. One of the main issues that we have with our clients is their ability to move around. For example, we have, say, plumbers, electricians, HVAC guys who will hire our clients every day to start off as apprentice or helpers, but they require a driver's license. Well, most of our folks don't have drivers. Probably only 25 to 30% of our clients have an actual driver's license. So any program that will help folks easily or make it a clear path for them to get their driver's license. And normally it's fines, everything from child support to suspended license, driving with a suspended license, or just because they've been in prison so long, their driver's license never renewed. It does. There's no automatic renewal. Mm-hmm. And so those are small things that are really big things. To most people, oh, it's just a driver's license, but it's a major thing for someone getting out of prison because it limits their ability to get a job.
What's the number one complaint you get from people returning? Individuals returning?
I don't know if there's a number one complaint. I think the issue, the barrier. It's probably housing is probably right up there with the anxiety of being able to make a living. I mean, if you think about it, you get out of prison, you're given this bus pass. You know, someone picks you up from the Greyhound bus station and you're like, OK, now what? You know, some people have somewhere to live or a family member. A lot of our folks don't. And we provide 3 months housing. We provide 3 months bus passes as a part of our program. We help them with clothing. We have a clothing closet. So we try to meet all the needs. We help them apply for other support services. We try to match them with any service that we don't provide. We help our clients find that particular service, whether it may be health care, food stamps, et cetera.
Okay. So we have a call on the line. Stanley, you're on the line. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. How you doing?
Great.
I was concerned when you were talking about politics here, especially the Democratic Party here. I'm disappointed, and I'm a Blue Dog Democrat, go way back. But my concern is when we talk about leadership, especially in Jacksonville for African Americans, it's appalling. I don't see no opportunity for African Americans to move forward with the present African American leadership they have in Jacksonville.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Stanley, for that call. You want to comment on that?
I miss Stanley. I know him well. Not really, to be honest. I think that, you know, leadership is important. I think that, you know, it comes from the folks who are elected and the folks who are just in the community. I mean, I know Audrey personally. We've had a really strong relationship. We've run against each other a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And I think Audrey is a good leader. And the problem is oftentimes you can have good leadership. It's sort of the ability to build a consensus, to build the team and sort of build the strategic planning that's needed is the toughest part. So, I mean, I think it's unfortunate where the Democratic Party has been the last few years. But, I think there's a lot of opportunity. There's still opportunity for the party to, you know, just pull things together.
I've heard one of the biggest challenges in talking to some people, one of the biggest challenges is fundraising. And that's what sort of handicaps a lot of the efforts that the party has. And probably if you're looking at both parties in general, you know, the fundraising is the key part where they can, you know, sort of fund infrastructure to fielding candidates and supporting those.
I think that's been an issue in Duval County. If you look at other parts of the state, fundraising isn't hasn't been a big challenge. And some of it's, you know, just sort of the makeup of the city. You know, traditionally Jacksonville has been more conservative, and the business community and folks who donate to political parties have traditionally donated more so to the Republican Party. But, you know, I think, again, the right strategy, the right plan, and you can start, you know, chipping away at that and slowly making a difference.
Mm-hmm. So what does Operation New Hope do to get the community involved in what they're doing? How does the organization, you know, sort of tap into all of the resources that are here locally? Because it would be my expectation that the more people know about what the work that you all are doing, that they would want to help support being successful in providing better opportunities for second chance individuals.
Certainly. And there's a number of ways. One is employers. You know, We reach out to employers on a regular basis saying, hey, give our folks a chance. And we take people through this program. We get them workforce ready. We deal with their life skills and getting them ready to come and work for you and give our people a chance. And so whether it's an employer or we have a life coach program to say you want to come and you want to be involved and you want to be a mentor, you want to help someone stay on the right path or just be a shoulder or a voice, an extra voice. So there's a number of ways, a number of volunteer opportunities.
So number one, you would be provide jobs.
Oh, certainly. If you're an employer, give us a chance. I mean, we're not saying, hey, just trust us. Give us a chance. Hire one or two of our people. And, you know, we guarantee that they'll be properly vetted. And, you know, we do a great job of training our people and getting them ready. And one of the things we make sure, like, look, you have to be substance free to get in this program. Mm-hmm. You have to have your mind right. And, you know, we vet everyone on the front end very heavily. And that's because we want, you know, our reputation's on the line. If Charles Griggs hires one of our Ready for Work graduates, we want Charles Griggs to have a great experience. And it's a win-win situation. You get a great employee, and then we've done our job in getting someone trained to come and work for you. And then, you know, it helps them get their life together. And that's one of the things I'm proud about. Most of our average job wages are well over $11 an hour. So we're pushing that up. I mean, we would like our average job wage to be $13 an hour or $14 an hour. So we're trying to provide our clients with living wages that they can truly take care of their families and get back on their feet.
Okay. So I'm gonna go back a little bit. I want to ask you this question. What made you think or believe that you were at this particular point, given the 2.5 years you've sort of been out of the limelight, out of the picture, that you were ready for work, so to speak, no pun intended,
right,
for such a public position at an organization like Operation New Hope? What made you feel like this was the right timing for you?
Well, I just felt
I'm asking that question because when you mentioned how when people come out of the system, they have a lot of anxieties about things that are going on in their life.
Oh, certainly. I mean, for me, the timing was right from the sense of some time had passed and just, you know, it's not like I've been sitting around not doing anything. So I've been working over the last couple of years, real estate and project management and doing some things. And, you know, when the opportunity came about, I just felt like it was time. And I've been working in the I continue writing for the Jacksonville Free Press. I've done that now for 19 years. I've been writing in the Jacksonville Free Press. So, you know, if you're ever bored and you want to read one of my columns, typically we're online or you can get a subscription. And so it's not, I never stop with public service. So either volunteering at a not-for-profit or talking to some kids or writing for the Free Press, talking about important issues in society or in political issues. So I never stopped. And so when this opportunity came about, it just felt like a natural fit. Again, my not-for-profit background, my political background, and the fact that I just have this passion for community service and helping folks, I just felt like this was a perfect job for me.
Okay. Well, full disclosure, I'm a contributing writer for the Jacksonville Free Press as well. So sometimes our articles cross paths.
Certainly.
Now, Operation New Hope is doing an event in July this month to talk about.
I'm
going to get that in before we get off the air.
Very exciting. It's not necessarily Operation New Hope, but it's One Jacks and some other groups have combined. We're doing our first ever Nelson Mandela International Day. And there's a big gala on July 17th. Dr. Mandela, Nelson Mandela's daughter, will be here. Mm-hmm. And this is the only city in the country that's doing that she's coming to for a national, international Nelson Mandela Day. And we're honoring some awesome local people. Melissa Nelson, who we talked about. Jennifer Brown, who's the executive director of KIPP Schools. Darnell Smith at Florida Blue and Kevin Gay, our founder at Operation New Hope.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Well, I think, you know, it's good to have you back. I think most people who've probably seen you around town, you know, have been asking, you know, what is Reggie Fullwood doing? And now you have an answer.
Certainly.
We appreciate you coming in and talk a little bit about what's going on. And thank you for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back.
AEG presents the Allman Betts Band. Devin Allman and Dwayne Betts are the sons of the Allman Brothers co-founders Greg Allman and Dickie Betts. Show date October 24th, Ponte Vedra Concert Hall, 7 p.m. Tickets available at Ticketmaster.com. Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit WJCT.org/events to explore what's coming your way.
I'm Lindsay Kilbride, host of WJCT's podcast, What It's Like. It starts with some of the best conversations recorded in Jacksonville by StoryCorps.
I remember being on the school bus and passing by and seeing you outside. You were under the addiction at the time.
And then I go deeper into the story.
How do you cope with the guilt you still feel? How do you cope with that?
Subscribe to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a drive with us into the blues horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Several new statewide laws go into effect today, including a ban on vaping and the use of e-cigarettes from indoor use in non-smoking areas, including workplaces. Here now with more from Tobacco-Free Florida are Heather Scartelli and Tobacco Prevention Program Area Program Director, and Julie Collins, Youth Programs Coordinator. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Right,
we're going to take some calls on this subject, and so give us a call at 549-2937 if you want to know more about the new laws that are going into effect today regarding vaping, because it's going to be very interesting because people have been getting away with a lot of stuff over the last few years since vaping has become popular. And so we want to try to inform our listeners on what they need to know. So first of all, if you would, tell us the difference between vaping and cigarette smoking.
Oh, yeah, definitely. A lot of people are probably familiar with seeing people vape now, with this sharp rise over the last few years. But unlike traditional tobacco smoking or chewing tobacco, vaping is a liquid nicotine, and people inhale it through a vaporizer. And the vaporizer heats the liquid, and you breathe in aerosol that's actually not vapor, but it's an aerosol of the liquid nicotine and some other chemicals and maybe flavoring, depending on the type of device or the brand that the person is using. And they get a nicotine fix from that type of action.
Okay. So now tell us a little bit about the new law. What does this ban do, and who's going to be most impacted off the top?
Yeah. Back in 1985, the state of Florida enacted the Florida Clean Indoor Air Act. And since then, we have not been able to use traditional tobacco products smoking in most workplaces and indoor public areas. This year, actually back in November, there was a constitutional amendment on the ballot, and Floridians overwhelmingly supported adding the act of vaping to the Florida Clean Indoor Air Act. Mm-hmm. So now we are not able to vote. Any Floridian is not able to use those vapor devices, vaping, in most public places where smoking is already banned.
Okay. That seems reasonable. But why would it be a problem?
Well, I think since we've had the increase in vaping over the last few years, since about 2011, 2012, and there were no laws, it was kind of like the wild, wild west of using these devices. Most places didn't really know how to regulate them. There was no federal or state regulation or a lot of local regulations. So it was kind of like, yeah, if I want to use this, I can, since there was no law on the books. So I think really being able to bring these devices in line with the Florida Clean Indoor Air Act is going to be a better solution for all of us to protect the air and the right to health that people have in the state of Florida.
So are there places that people can still vape legally indoors, or...
Yeah, there are any place that is already allowed to have cigarette smoke, such as standalone bars. They'll still allow vaping in those types of areas.
Private residences,
outdoors as well, in most places, unless it's a business that owns a patio and they've already banned it.
So this was a pretty popular voter approved amendment.
Yes.
And so folks spoke loudly. I think it was about 70% of the people said yes.
It had to be at least over 60% to be approved. And most Floridians over the last few years, there's been a lot of polling and a lot of Floridians supported bringing these vaping devices in line with the Florida Clean Indoor Air Act.
So what about the long-term health effects of vaping? Because there have been some controversy about that. Mm-hmm. People believe that this is much better than regular, you know, traditional cigarette smoking. Mm-hmm. Is there any truth to that?
Well, the jury's still out. So the long-term effects of using these products is still being studied. But what we do know is that there are short-term effects that are still harmful to a person's health. And what we like to say is that harmful doesn't mean harmless. So there is still a risk when you choose to use these products. And this law hopefully will protect the people who are choosing not to use them from the secondhand vapor that's generated by these devices that we do know have chemicals in it that could be harmful to someone's respiratory system.
The number to call is 549-2937 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. I want to talk a little bit about youth because that's a big deal. We know that traditional tobacco, the entry point for them is early, right? For kids, it's very early, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. And so what is the impact on vaping to youth? I mean, are they using this as an alternative to traditional tobacco?
Yes. Overwhelmingly, in Florida, about one in four youth, high school age youth, are using these e-cigarette devices. And about one in three has tried them. The flavors being an overwhelmingly popular reason these kids start using these products. And with such high rates, we're really nervous to see the addiction rates amongst our youth. The brain doesn't stop developing until you're 25 years old. So youth are making this decision before their brain has stopped developing. So
has this led to going into traditional cigarette smoking, has it led to youth doing traditional cigarettes? Are they starting to smoke earlier or using this as an alternative?
Yes. We're seeing that that youth are transitioning into that because of such high levels of nicotine that are in some of these products that the kids are using. It's a little bit different than back in the day when kids were sneaking cigarettes here and there. These products are easily concealable from parents and adults that may not know what these devices look like. And they're sneakily using, way more nicotine than our generations beforehand.
So what can parents do in a situation like this where typically they can't smell it, right? It's usually doesn't have an odor to it, the e-cigarettes and these vaping devices. What can parents do to help with managing this or restricting it from their children?
I would say, talk to your child first, talk to your youth first, and make sure that you have open communication with your youth about what these products are and how often they're seeing it amongst their peers at school and otherwise. Also, stay educated and be proactive. Tobacco-Free Florida's website is a really great beginning resource to begin educating yourself about what these products are. And if you have the open line of communication with your youth, very likely they'll tell you what products are really popular amongst their friends and peers. I think that open communication and just staying proactive is the most important part because many parents don't even know what these devices look like. So making sure that they do their own research as well.
E-cigarettes have been very controversial across the country. In fact, San Francisco, I guess they're the first city to ban e-cigarette sales altogether.
Yeah.
What type of an impact do you think that'll have on our local policies? Do you see a day when, e-cigarettes are banned altogether?
Maybe down the distant horizon, the Tobacco Free Jacksonville Coalition, they're a 501c3 that's been around the community for over 30 years. And they're a group of volunteer advocates that really look at what they can do to prevent tobacco use and exposure among residents here in Jacksonville and the First Coast. And they're really looking at this issue. They're concerned and they're looking at it as a youth access issue. So they're working right now with city leaders to kind of really understand how youth are really obtaining these products. It is illegal for you to purchase or possess, and it's illegal to sell vaping devices and all the stuff that goes along with them to anyone under 18. So they're looking at how youth are gaining access to these products and working with the city leaders to kind of find a common sense solution that would further restrict youth access to the devices. And we think that's a really good first step. The state of Florida also has been flirting with raising the sales age of all tobacco and nicotine products at a statewide level each legislative session for the past few years. And we anticipate that might be, again, the case for the session coming up in 2020.
Yeah, that sounds like it's been getting grown. That's been growing every year.
Yeah, it's a nationwide trend.
Yeah, so, trying to up the age. But you know, one of the things that we, like I mentioned earlier, is that we see youth coming into smoking habits earlier, mm-hmm. they're being introduced to tobacco earlier. And the concern is that these e-cigarettes make it easier for them to conceal, their tobacco products or assimilate what they're doing with cigarettes.
Yeah. And, you know, vaping is a little bit of a different action than smoking a traditional product. You know, when you smoke a cigarette, you have to use a lighter. There's a burning thing. It's hot. It's smoky. It's a very stinky smell associated with it. Mm-hmm. With vaping, there's usually relatively no or little odor. The newer pod-based devices that use nicotine salts don't have a big puff cloud like some of the earlier types of vaping devices that we saw on the market a few years ago. So and there's no heat. So it's just like breathing in a straw. So the ease of use is very concerning, and it's easy for youth to really get addicted and use these products a lot.
And to add on the nicotine salts in the pod based systems, they make it so it's not as harsh to your throat. So youth that are using them, they're not having any trouble using them. It's very easy for them to breathe in the flavors of, you know, Mystic Mango or whatever flavors are out there. So it's very easy for them to consume and enjoy as well, which is not what we would like.
Yeah, you mentioned that the flavors are what kind of gets the kids, and the traditional cigarettes doesn't have, other than the quote menthol flavor.
Right.
Right. So they get used to that as a process.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the flavors are what are something that's very concerning to us. Because it's enticing the youth. Mm-hmm. If you look at the adult vaping rates, it's about 4% compared to 1 in 4, 25% high school students are using these products, but only 4% of adults are. Mm-hmm. So,
are students working with you all on this, on trying to educate and help curb the use of e-cigarettes?
Yeah, they are. Our partnership, and then Julie coordinates the Students Working Against Tobacco program. And part of our job over the last year or two has been to really educate not only students, but also school faculty and community members on what these products are and what they do. And I think our SWAT youth are really behind trying to educate their peers. They have a statewide campaign called Not a Lab Rat, where they talk about, you know, not being a guinea pig for these products.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here. Heather Scartelli and Julie Collins with Tobacco Free Florida, thank you for being here. And we'll be right back with Culpepper and the latest sports.
On the next Fresh Air, the human toll of moderating Facebook's content. We talk with journalist Casey Newton about the people who work for outside contractors monitoring texts or images of hate, murder, child exploitation, animal abuse, and more. Many workers are traumatized. One contractor died. Newton also will tell us what Facebook is doing about it. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Stairway to Heaven, the Led Zeppelin classic, has been in a legal battle for years, and it might not be the only classic with copyright troubles.
Holy cow, is it possible that all of the greatest solos of jazz, rock, the saxophones, the guitars, were never register compositions?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, copyright law and classic rock, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT. The important role that Florida played in the American Revolution is often overlooked. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the 14th and 15th colonies of East and West Florida. We'll talk about Sunnyland Magazine from the 1920s and the B-52 bomber in Orlando. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Actor George Takei says family separations and squalid migrant detention centers are nothing new for our nation. He spent time in Japanese internment camps as a child following Pearl Harbor. The Star Trek star is sharing his story in new ways with a graphic novel and a TV horror series based on historical events. George Takei, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, June is quite a month for U.S. soccer. Could July be even better?
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper is here with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Charles. Yeah, the U.S. men's and women's national teams have both enjoyed great success in their biggest tournaments of the year. Let's start with the women, who beat France on Friday to earn a spot in the semifinals of the World Cup. Megan Rapinoe has emerged as the figure of the tournament. Not only has she scored 5 goals, tied for most of them, but she's performed at key times for the United States. This all amid a political firestorm that emerged after she was quoted as saying she would not go to the White House if the U.S. won. She's been the catalyst for the United States and could play a key role on Tuesday when tomorrow to you and me, when the United States faces England in the semifinals. Interestingly, some English newspapers, the Daily Mail for one, asking the question, are the United States players too arrogant at this point, citing, among other things, the fact that the U.S. celebrated all the goals in a 13-0 whitewashing of Thailand back in the group stage. It's also, of course, remember the fact that, take some shots at the opposing team. There are some photos that were in the Daily Mail today showing Megan Rapinoe and some of her teammates looking brash and arrogant. Whether they're arrogant or confident, you can be the judge.
Yeah, winning is winning.
It's also the number one team in the world, so are they too arrogant? We'll find out tomorrow, perhaps, against England. Remember, the United States has won 3 World Cups, but they've never won back-to-back World Cups. They could do that with 2 more wins. If they beat England, they'll face either Sweden or the Netherlands in the finals. That would be on Sunday. Remember, the United States beat Sweden 2-0 in the group stage as well. By the way, Jacksonville is apparently really taken to this tournament. We were the 5th highest rated market for TV viewership in Friday's U.S. versus France matchup.
I have more confidence in the women than I do the men.
Well, you should. You're talking about the number one team in the world in the women. The men are ranked 30th in the world. However, and while it's not the World Cup, the Gold Cup, which is a tournament the biggest for them this year, consists of countries in North and Central America, the Caribbean, and a handful of smaller South American countries as well. And the United States beat Curaçao 1-0 yesterday in the Gold Cup to advance. The U.S. will face Jamaica on Wednesday night in the Gold Cup semifinals. Charles, you recall that the last time the United States tried to qualify for the World Cup and failed to, it created a clean the deck situation. Yeah. They've changed the roster. They've changed the head coach. Greg Berhalter is now the head coach. And they really hadn't had the kind of results or performances you'd want to see out of a new group until this tournament. Now they're starting to come together. Christian Pulisic is the star of the United States team, plays professionally, had been playing in Germany, now will be playing in England in the Premier League for Chelsea. So he's the guy who has really made it go for the United States and a guy who is a star on the rise on the international scene as well. We'll see how they do.
They're treating them like they're an NBA team.
Well,
wiping the slate clean.
And no salary cap, of course, so that makes it easier. But there were a lot of changes that had to be made. There are some holdovers from the previous World Cup team that made it, including Michael Bradley, who's been a guy who's been pretty steady there through the years. But this is there are a lot of guys who have been playing for MLS clubs and elsewhere who are finally getting a chance to showcase themselves, including Weston McKennie, who scored the goal in the game last night. So some new faces emerging on the U.S. soccer scene for sure as they go from the Jurgen Klinsmann era now to the era with Greg Berhalter.
It's good to see more players coming up through our system that are making it to the teams that are representing, because normally what we've done is we've, you know, sort of relied on players who've played for other, you know, other areas that have been good.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing the MLS get stronger, and that's helping a bit, but you're also seeing the development system take baby steps forward. I think a lot of folks in soccer still think that the United States development system has a long way to go before they get to the a place where it is, say, in South America or in Europe. But there is some progress being made. Now we'll see if it continues. Mm-hmm. Of course, the next World Cup comes up in a couple of years. So we'll see how the United States handles all of that. Mm-hmm. Saturday, by the way, we'll go from soccer to NASCAR. I don't have a clever transition for this. but we'll see the we'll see the final race in July at Daytona on Saturday when NASCAR runs there. Next year, the schedule changes. And Daytona will not only host the season-opening Daytona 500, but also the last race of the regular season, which will be in August. It's a big departure from tradition. They've run a race on or around Independence Day at Daytona since 1959. That was also the first year they ran the Daytona 500, so this will be a huge change. And if you think about it, Charles, NASCAR is a league that has really clung to tradition. It's a big part of what they're all about. And this is a big departure. It's going to be interesting to see how that is received. A lot of the drivers really like to come to Daytona in July, bring their families on a vacation to Daytona Beach. That won't happen necessarily in August.
Wow, that is going to be a big change. It's going to be interesting how people adjust to it.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And also how it is seen and viewed and by how many people. You know, the NFL season will be getting underway in August with the preseason, so a little different kind of competition.
Yes, yes, yes. Can't wait. Can't wait for the NFL season. Okay. Well, thanks for the news and the latest in sports.
Thank you, Charles.
All right. Appreciate it. And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. If you have any questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, the push to preserve Fish Island. That's tomorrow on First Coast Connect.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.